March. So, hello, I'm Richard Stallman. I'm going to speak about what goes beyond free software. You see, as I started giving speeches in the 90s, more often about free software, I got an interesting pattern of questions. So let me introduce this by summarizing very quickly what free software is all about. First of all, it's free as in freedom, not price. It's Jayu software. And what it means is that the users have four essential freedoms. Freedom zero is the freedom to run the program as you wish. Freedom one is the freedom to study the source code and change it so the program does what you wish when you run it. Freedom two is the freedom to help your neighbor, the freedom to distribute copies of the program when you wish. And freedom three is the freedom to help build your community, the freedom to distribute copies of your modified versions when you wish. With all four freedoms, the program is free software because it respects the freedom and social solidarity of the users. So free software is software that is whose social system of distribution and use is an ethical system because it respects the community of users. Non-free software is unethical, it's evil, because it's an attempt to subjugate the users. This, no matter how useful the program may be in a technical, practical sense, the social system of its distribution and use is unethical, which means that overall the program is unethical. So as I was giving speeches about this, people would ask me, do these ideas extend to anything other than software? Like, what about microphones? Should microphones be free? Or shirts? Or cars? Or computers? Well, it's a silly question. Because keep in mind what we mean when we say software is free. It means that the user has the four freedoms. So does that apply to microphones or shirts? Well, first of all, look at freedom zero, the freedom to use it. Well, if you own a microphone or a shirt, you pretty much are free to use it any way you like. Okay, so in that sense, that part of it, it is, for that freedom, it is free. What about freedom number one, the freedom to study the source code and change it? Well, there is no source code for microphones or shirts. You can modify the shirt. You could take scissors or a needle and thread, and you're free to do that to the extent it's possible. But modifying a microphone is not very possible. There's very many of the things inside this wireless microphone are probably chips that nobody can modify. It's impossible. What about freedom number two, the freedom to copy it and distribute copies? Well, there are no copiers for shirts or microphones or cars or computers. It might be nice if we had car copiers, you know. Imagine if you had a car and one day somebody walked up to it and stuck his car copier onto it, and on the other side of his car copier, another car just like yours was produced. And then he would pick up his car copy and get into the copy and drive it away. And you would never notice because your car would still be there, just the same place, the same way you left it. You wouldn't even know it had been copied. Well, that would be fine, but it's science fiction. There are no car copiers. So freedom number two is a meaningless question for physical objects, generally. And likewise, freedom three. Since there are no copiers, you can't copy your modified versions. In fact, modified versions doesn't even make sense. You can take some kinds of physical objects and change them, but you can't make copies and distribute copies of your modified object because there are no copiers. So basically what we find is most physical objects are as close to free as they could possibly be. But there are some kinds of things for which this question does make sense. Other kinds of information works, because those could be in your computer and you can copy them and you can change them. So the four freedoms all make sense. It makes sense to ask whether other kinds of information works should be free. That doesn't mean that the answer is the same for all kinds of works, but it does mean the question makes sense. Now, if you have an information work that is not software, and it isn't free, in most cases, the only possible reason is copyright law. Software is an exception, because software, proprietary user subjugating software, typically has an end user license agreement. But that's not normal for other kinds of information works. If they're not free, it's because of copyright law. So, taking the same question and looking at it from the other side, it becomes, what should copyright law say? To think about this question, leaving so soon, I hope it wasn't something I said. Well, I'll continue anyway. So, to think about copyright law, we should place it in context by considering the history of copyright, which is connected with the history of copying technology. And copying technology is important because it affects the ethical issues of copyright. Now, basic changes in technology cannot alter basic ethical principles. Basic ethical principles are too deep to be reached by something as superficial as a change in technology. But when we apply ethical principles to a particular question, we do it by looking at the consequences of our possible actions. And the context can change the consequences of an action. And that can make the action better or worse. Suppose that we could bring dead people back to life, then killing somebody wouldn't really be so bad. They wouldn't really be dead. So it would change our ethical conclusions about killing people if it weren't permanent, right? We could bring them back to life. That's an illustration of what I mean. Technological changes can affect our conclusions about specific ethical questions. So let's look at the history of copying technology and copyright. Copying began in the ancient world when it was done with a pen and ink on paper or some other surface. Now, this technology had certain consequences. First of all, anybody who could read and write could copy about as efficiently as anybody else. No special skill or equipment needed for copying. Second, there was no economy of scale. To make 10 copies took 10 times as long as making one copy. So there was no particular reason to make large quantities of copies in one place. So the result was a decentralized system where anybody who had a copy of a book would make another copy when he wanted one. As far as I can tell, there was no such idea as copyright in the ancient world. If you had a copy of a book, you were allowed to copy it, unless the king didn't like what it said, in which case he might kill you. But that's a different thing. But not as different as you might think. However, there was a big improvement in copying technology, the printing press. The printing press made copying more efficient, but not uniformly more efficient, because the printing press made some kinds of copying much more efficient and had no effect in other cases. Because the printing press has an economy of scale. It takes a lot of work to set the type. But once you have done that, you can make many identical copies pretty fast. So the printing press is only efficient when you're going to make many copies. Furthermore, the printing press was specialized equipment. Most people who could read and write did not have a printing press, and nor did they have the skill of using one. The result was a centralized system of producing copies. Copies of any book would be produced in a few places and then transported to all the people who wanted copies. They would be made in batches and then sold individually. In the first centuries of printing, lots of copies were still made by hand. Typically, they were made either for very rich people to show how rich they were, or they were made by poor people, because printed copies of books were still fairly expensive. And as a famous song goes, time ain't money if all you've got is time. So there were poor people who couldn't afford to buy a copy of a book, but they had the time to write it. So they copied books by hand. Copyright began in the age of the printing press. In England, copyright began as a system of censorship. In order to be permitted to publish a book, you had to go to the government and get a copyright. And this copyright was permanent and belonged to a publisher. It was a very bad system. However, and this began in the 1500s, but in the 1700s it was reformed, and the idea was adopted that copyrights would belong to authors and would last a short time. I think it was 14 years. And the idea began that copyright was a system to encourage writing. And this was further developed when the United States Constitution was written. There was a proposal that authors be entitled to a copyright. This proposal was rejected. And instead, the US Constitution has a very interesting policy. It does not require a system of copyright, but it permits one, optionally. And it says that the purpose of copyright is to promote progress, and that the copyright must last for a limited time. Of course, when you hear the movie companies and the record companies talk about it, they don't like to mention these things. They give a completely contradictory idea, which they're now trying to spread around the world. Now, copyright in the age of the printing press functioned essentially as an industrial regulation. It didn't restrict readers. In fact, the first U.S. copyright law didn't cover copying as such. It covered printing and publication. So it didn't even nominally did not forbid poor people to copy books by hand. That was legal. And because copyright was an industrial regulation, it was easy to enforce, uncontroversial, and arguably beneficial. It was easy to enforce because it only had to be enforced against publishers. And it's easy to find who's publishing a book. You just go to a bookstore and ask, where did you get these copies? It's not necessary to invade everybody's privacy to find who's printing and selling books. It was pretty much uncontroversial because the ordinary readers were not being restricted, so they had no reason to complain. And it was arguably beneficial because the readers traded away a freedom that they could not exercise in practice, and in exchange received benefits such as more books being written, more books that you could buy in the bookstore, more conversation about important issues in society, which would help society figure out what to do. So, copyright made sense as a system in the age of the printing press. Around 1900, printing was mechanized and became much more efficient. And even poor people, if they could read and write, could afford printed copies of books. That's when cheap paperback books began. And I'm not quite sure why, but they then changed copyright law. One thing that they changed was that it covered copying. But nonetheless, nobody ever thought of trying to enforce copyright law against individuals who made one copy, because everyone understood it was an industrial regulation to restrict publishers on behalf of authors. And it wasn't supposed to bother the general public. However, the age of the printing press is giving way to the age of the computer networks, another improvement in copying technology. And like the first one, it makes copying more efficient, but not uniformly. So we have the ancient world where copying was all hard, and then the printing press made some cases efficient. And now digital information technology has another non-uniform effect. It makes the other cases efficient. So we now end up in a situation somewhat like the ancient world, where there's no longer much economy of scale, where making one copy is almost as efficient as making many copies. This is not perfectly true. It is true still that, for instance, mass producing CD-ROMs is a bit more efficient than producing them one by one, and they're more durable. But nonetheless, making CD-ROMs one at a time is cheap enough that hundreds of millions of people can do it. So we're back in a situation like the ancient world, where copying all sorts of works can be done by ordinary users of these works, and they can do it in a perfectly efficient way. The publishers like to say that digital information technology causes problems for copyright law. By putting it that way, they show their bias. because they're assuming that copyright law is what's really important, and digital information technology is just some nuisance that gets in the way. I think we should put it the other way around. Copyright causes problems for our use of digital information technology. Because now that we all can copy, and not just theoretically, but really practically, we can copy, the result is that copyright law, even the same copyright law that there was 50 years ago, changes its effect. It's no longer an industrial regulation on publishers in the name of authors with benefits for the public. Now, it's a restriction on the public in the name of authors to benefit publishers. Turn it around, almost. What has happened is that the freedom that we used to trade away because we couldn't exercise it, now is useful for everyone. And now people want to exercise this freedom. So the result is copyright is no longer effectively an industrial regulation, and therefore it's no longer easy to enforce, no longer uncontroversial, and no longer beneficial. It's no longer easy to enforce because it has to be enforced against everybody by invading their homes and computers. It's no longer uncontroversial because people get angry when they're stopped from sharing. And it's no longer beneficial because now we're paying something very important. We're paying our freedom. We're paying our freedom to share with each other. And sharing is the basis of society. So copyright law, even if it had not changed at all, would have become harmful. The same copyright law, which in 1950 was sensible and useful, would be harmful today. So, what would democratic governments do in response to this? Well, these governments are trading away our freedom to get certain benefits, and they're doing so because of the idea that this freedom is useless, so we might as well trade it. But now we want to keep it. So our representatives would decide to renegotiate the deal. They would say, we can't trade all of this freedom anymore because the people want to keep it. So they would reduce copyright law. They would reduce the amount of freedom that we give up. Maybe they wouldn't get rid of copyright law, but they would make it less powerful, less restrictive, so that the public could go ahead and do what the public wants to do. What governments are actually doing is the direct opposite. And that shows how undemocratic they are. Instead of governments of the people, by the people, for the people, we have governments of the people, by the flunkies, for the corporations. And what they're doing is increasing copyright power in every possible way. So, one thing that they've increased is the length of time that copyright lasts. In 1998, the U.S. extended copyright law by 20 years for both old works and new works. Now, one might ask how 20 more years of copyright for works written in the 1920s is going to convince those now dead authors to write more. If they have a time machine, they have not shown it to us. And apparently they haven't used it because our history books have not changed. So it's a complete mystery to me. Theoretically, 20 more years of copyright for future works could be more of an incentive to produce them. But I really don't think any author is going to be terribly concerned about whether copyright will continue more than 50 years after he dies. I don't think anybody would have chosen not to write because 50 years after their death was not enough. And as for works made by businesses, so-called works made for hire, those used to have 75 years of copyright. Now they have 95. Well, any business that wanted to claim that 75 years of copyright was not enough should have shown us their projected balance sheets for 75 years in the future. Of course, businesses don't really even look ahead 10 years. So the whole thing is a joke. What it really is about is this. Disney didn't want Mickey Mouse to go into the public domain. The copyright on Steamboat Willie was going to expire in a few more years. That was the first movie that Mickey Mouse appeared in. So Disney wanted to keep its monopoly that was supposed to last for a limited time. They have figured out a scheme for perpetual copyright on the installment plan. That is to say, theoretically, copyright lasts for a fixed amount of time. So any given work is supposed to fall into the public domain at a certain date. But it's never going to happen. When you get to that date, they'll have pushed it back. And when you get to the next date, they'll have pushed it back. And they keep on pushing it back. Every 20 years, they want to extend copyright by 20 more years. When there is something wrong in the United States government does not try to solve the problem. Instead, it tries to impose the problem on the rest of the world. And right now, the U.S. is trying to impose this problem on South Korea through a proposed free trade agreement, which should be rejected. For this reason alone, it would be enough reason to reject it. But of course, there are other bigger reasons to reject it. Free trade agreements are the enemy of democracy. That's their purpose. Their purpose is to give business more power than the people. To transfer power from governments that may be more or less democratic to businesses which don't even claim that they ought to be democratic, and thus turn democracy into a fiction, limited to questions that are not important to business. The other dimension where copyright has been extended is the dimension of how much power it gives. You see, copyright was never supposed to cover all uses of a copyrighted work. Copyrighted uses, uses covered by copyright, were an exception in a broader space of unregulated uses. So there are all sorts of things that people could do with written works, and some of them were restricted by copyright. But publishers, being corporations, are now arrogantly seeking total power. In the US, they got this total power in 1998 through the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. That was a law that effectively permitted publishers to write their own copyright rules by encoding them in software. The DMCA says that when a work is published with DRM, Digital Restrictions Management, then any kind of device that enables the users to escape from their restrictions is illegal. For example, in the US, the free software to play a DVD is illegal. DVDs are an example of digital restrictions management. The movie on a DVD is encrypted, and the encryption was secret. The plan was, and the scheme that they implemented was a conspiracy of companies to restrict the public. Here's how it worked. Anybody who wanted to make DVDs or make DVD players had to sign a contract with the DVD conspiracy. And the contract said that they would keep the format secret and they would restrict the public. So all DVD players were required to restrict the public in certain ways. Then, some hackers in Europe figured out the format, and they wrote a free program that could read the movie off the DVD and play it. This free program is illegal in the US. It's censored. The US practices censorship of software. And I think that this is another thing that the US is now trying to impose on South Korea through the proposed free trade agreement, which should not be signed. So, what we see is an arrogant power grab on the part of the publishers. We can see this, for instance, with e-books. About 5 years ago, there was a tremendous amount of hype for e-books. Everywhere you look, you would see something talking about how you were really going to love e-books. It was an orchestrated, paid-for commercial hype campaign, I'm pretty sure. And ironically, one of these publishers decided they wanted to start off their line of e-books with a biography of me. So they hired an author and had him come ask me if I would cooperate with this. Now, it's an interesting thing about my life that opportunities to practice my own principles keep falling into my lap. In the things I'm doing, I constantly find cases where I have to say no to things because the usual way of doing them violates what I'm fighting for. So I told that author, I'll cooperate with this if this ebook is published without encryption. Go back and ask the publisher. And the publisher said no. So I said to him, look for another publisher. And he found one. And in fact, that book is actually free. It's published with the Four Freedoms. So ebooks are the way that publishers of books want to take away the traditional freedoms of readers. Freedoms to do things like borrow a book from the library, buy a used book, to lend a book to your friend, to buy a book anonymously, paying cash, and even the freedom to keep the book for many years and read it again and again. All these traditional freedoms that book readers enjoy, the publishers want to get rid of. They want to convert the whole world into pay-per-view. And they came up with a two-stage plan to do this. Because they didn't think that they could get away with simply passing a law to take away these freedoms from book readers. There are millions of people who read books, and they would have got angry. So instead, they made this two-stage plan. Stage one, take away these freedoms for e-books. That was easy because there were no e-books. There were no e-book readers, so there was nobody to get angry. And they did that in the U.S. with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. Second stage, convince people to switch from printed books to e-books. Well, that didn't work. But they're going to try again. They'll keep on trying until they win or they get crushed. A year ago, Sony was in the news for an extremely nasty system of DRM on corrupt disks. A corrupt disk is something that looks like a CD, but it isn't a real CD. So these were CDs designed to restrict the user. And they did it by installing a rootkit in the user's operating system. And this rootkit did various other nasty things. It disguised its own presence. It was hard to remove. It damaged the security of the computer. And it also contained illegally copied code under the GNU General Public License. So Sony managed to do just about every other nasty thing anybody could think of. And that, unfortunately, distracted people's attention from the fact that simply implementing DRM is nasty in itself. What made that Sony DRM bad is the fact it was DRM. And all those other nasty things just made it a bit worse. But ironically, that particular DRM would not bother you unless you were running Windows. So if you were using a free operating system like GNU plus Linux, you were safe. Many ironies in this. So Sony has learned its lesson. Next time, the rootkit is supposed to be built into your computer before you get it, and it will be impossible to remove. DRM schemes are usually conspiracies of businesses. For instance, the DVD restrictions, encryption, was designed by a group of companies that are working together to impose restrictions on the public. That should be a crime. When businesses conspire to impose restrictions on the public that the public can't escape from, their executives should go to prison. But that's not what happens. Instead, governments pass laws to support them. Laws like the DMCA in the US and similar laws in many other countries. And if you don't win, here as well. Now, I am not speculating when I talk of conspiracies, because these conspiracies are not secret. They are openly announced. They have websites where they say which companies are sponsoring them. They have so little fear that our governments will defend our freedom that they don't even need to hide. That's why I can confidently tell you that these are conspiracies. Because they say so. So this is what non-democratic government is doing to copyright law, turning it into a prison. But what would governments do if they were democratic? Well, they would be reducing copyright law. But how? Well, one dimension is a dimension of length of time. They've been extending copyright to last longer and longer. What they should do is shrink it. You see, an interesting thing has happened. In the same decades that the copyright term has been extended over and over, the publication cycle has been getting shorter and shorter. I don't know what it's like here, but in the US, the typical book is remainder. All the copies are sold off in less than 2 years. And within 3 years, it's out of print. So why should copyright have to last a century? So I suggest reducing copyright to 10 years. 10 years starting from publication. Because as long as the author has the only copy, there's no harm letting him have more time. But when it gets published, then the 10-year clock should start counting. That should be enough. But not everybody agrees with this 10-year proposal. I once made this proposal in a panel with some authors. And the award-winning fantasy author sitting next to me said, 10 years would be intolerable, nothing more than 5 years. I'm amazed you are not reacting. I was rather stunned when I heard that. I had been assuming, naively, that authors would all want more copyright. And here he was saying, no, no, 10 years is too long. Only 5 years. There was a reason for this. You see, he had a dispute with his publisher. That's not unusual for authors. His book contract had a standard clause that when the book goes out of print, the rights revert to him and he can once again do whatever he wants with his own book. But although his book was out of print, the publisher refused to admit it. And he had been forced to, I believe, to get a lawyer and start threatening to sue his publisher to get permission to distribute his own book. This is common. You see, these arrogant corporations that are demanding more power over us in the name of these wonderful authors are constantly grinding these authors into the ground with their heels. In the same year as the DMCA and the Mickey Mouse Copyright Term Extension Act, the record companies bought another change in copyright law in the US, which stripped some musicians of some of their rights and gave those rights to the record companies. They're claiming that they're serving the authors and the artists, but that's a lie. Or more precisely, it's a 90% lie. Maybe you've heard the saying that a half-truth can be worse than a lie. Well, this is 10% true and 90% lie. A lot of statements made by business today are 10% true and 90% lie. They're very good at misrepresenting situations that way. And because there's a little bit of truth in it, they can get away with it. And they can hide the 90% lie. When publishers say that they're doing this for the authors and artists, it's true that a small fraction of those authors and artists do benefit. The ones who are very famous, the ones that you've heard of, the few that everybody's heard of, those are the ones who benefit. And the rest are getting shafted. So, I suggest 10-year copyright as the first step. And then we can see the results. And we might adjust it down or maybe even a little bit up. We can tune it to make it optimal. But 10 years, I propose, is the first step. The other question is, what should copyright cover? Which activities should be restricted and which activities should be permitted? For this, the crucial thing is, it doesn't have to be the same for all works. We don't have to make the same trade for everything we buy. We don't have to pay the same price for everything we buy. So we can divide works into different categories and treat each category in the way we think is best. I suggest three broad categories of works. And they're not divided up by the type of medium. That's the first thing everyone thinks of. What do you do for music? What do you do for video? What do you do for printed books? I think that's the wrong way. Because the medium is not what's important. The social use of the work, that's what affects what we need to be free to do. So I have three categories of works according to the way they contribute to society. There are the works that serve a practical purpose. They help you do something. They help you do a practical thing. There are the works that serve to say what certain people think or thought. And there are the works of art and entertainment, whose purpose lies in what it feels like to use the work. So, first, let's look at the works of practical use. These include software and recipes for cooking and educational works like textbooks and manuals and reference works such as dictionaries and encyclopedias. These works, I believe, must all be free. Of course, that makes sense. Software is in this category, and software should be free. But the other works should be free for the same reason. Because when you use a work in your life to carry out your life activities, in order to control your own life, you must be free to change the work, to make it do the right thing for you. But once you have changed it, you've got to be free to publish your version, because there are probably other people who want the same thing you want, other people for whom your version will be better. And you've got to be free to contribute to society by publishing your version to make it available to those other people who will want it. Now, 20 years ago, people might have objected, saying that unless there is some way of restricting the users to make every user pay, these works won't be developed. 20 years ago, we didn't know if that was true. Today, we have lots of evidence to show that they're wrong, that these works are being developed. First of all, there's the free software community, where we've developed many thousands of useful programs. And then if we look at the area of reference works, we can see Wikipedia. And now they're spreading into free educational books as well. So we can see that there is no need to deny users their freedom that they should have in order to produce these works of practical use. So this answers the question that I was asked at the end of my speeches. How far should this idea extend that, if software should be free, what other things should be free? Well, my answer is all the works that serve practical purposes must be free. But that leaves us with two other categories of works. What about them? Well, first of all, look at the works that state certain parties' views or thoughts. To change those works is to misrepresent those people. That's not a contribution to society. So there's no reason why people should be free to publish modified versions of the works in this category. Quoting passages is a different story. That is useful. But publishing a modified version is not. So this means that we could have a compromise copyright system which covers modification and commercial use. So anyone who wanted to use the work commercially or to publish in any way modified versions would still have to ask permission. But everybody should be free to non-commercially distribute exact copies. That's the minimum freedom that everybody must have so as to turn copyright back into an industrial regulation and permit everyone to exercise the freedom to copy and share. Sharing is friendship, and anyone that tries to prohibit sharing is trying to prohibit friendship. That's an enemy of society. The minimum freedom that everyone must have for all kinds of works, no matter what they are, all published works, that is the freedom to distribute exact copies non-commercially. So with this compromised copyright system, we would continue to have a system that supports the authors more or less. Of course, our current system doesn't support authors very well, with the usual 10% exception. There are a few famous authors who are making lots and lots of money, and those are just a few, a tiny fraction, and the rest are really being supported very badly. What about the works of art and entertainment? Well, for these works, the issue of modification is a difficult issue. There are valid arguments on both sides. On one side, there's the argument that the work can have an artistic integrity, and modifying it could destroy that integrity. I believe that this is sometimes true, but this argument is weakened by the way that most authors eagerly allow Hollywood to destroy all the integrity of their writings in exchange for enough money. If they really believed in the artistic integrity of their writings, they would not allow this. On the other hand, meanwhile, look at the folk process, where the transformation of the same work by many different people can produce something rich and Shakespeare would not have been allowed to stage these plays or to publish them, and we would never have seen them. And if Shakespeare had complained, the copyright holders would have said, oh, you just want to make a cheap ripoff of our work. That's junk. Why should anyone allow that? And if we had never seen those plays, we might have believed that was true. But because we have seen these plays, we say that they are among the masterpieces of human literature. So, there is a lot of reason to allow modified versions of artistic works. But one crucial thing is, it's not urgent. It can wait a while. So, with works that you use to do jobs in your life, if the work is not convenient for you today, you have to be free to change it today. And you should be able to publish your modified version today so that other people get the benefit of the change, because they need it. Oh, that's a bad sound. With artistic works, modifying them can be a contribution to art, and it should happen, but it doesn't have to happen today. It could wait 10 years. So if we have copyright lasting for 10 years, and then after that, everyone can publish modified versions of that work of art. But during the 10 years, there's a compromised copyright system, the same one. It permits everyone to distribute exact copies non-commercially, but everything else requires permission. Then this would provide support for the artists more or less the way the current system does, which is not very well, but at least it's something. Now, people are thinking, of course, a lot about music sharing on the internet. Music sharing on the internet is non-commercial distribution of exact copies. This must be legalized. It's wrong to stop people from sharing. Suppose we did this, how would it affect musicians? The answer is, in general, it wouldn't hurt them at all. And the reason is that if you buy a commercial CD, most of the CDs in the store, how much does the musician get? Zero. The record companies are mistreating the artists, even as they say that it's wrong for us to share the music because it hurts the artists. They are the ones who are hurting the artists. Most musicians never get anything when you buy their records. The contracts that the record companies sign with the musicians are so unfair that nearly all records never result in the musicians getting anything when people buy their records. Nominally, a certain part of the record's price is for the musician, but the musician never sees that because the record company says that the production expenses and the publicity expenses are treated as an advance to the musician. So when you buy the record, a certain amount of the money goes from one account in the record company to another account in the record company. A tiny fraction of records sell so many copies that they actually fully repay the production and publicity expenses, and then they start actually giving money to the musicians. But records can even go gold and not start to bring money to the musicians. So what do musicians get from their record contracts? They get a certain amount of advance at the beginning, but it's not very much. What they really get is publicity. You know, the record company spends money on publicity. This does have an effect. It means that more people come to the musicians' concerts, and they do more concerts. And at their concerts, they can sell some of their records, and they get a bit more that way. So, and they can sell other things as well to their fans. So the benefit that the musicians are really getting is publicity. But this is a sick system for giving them publicity because it's controlled by record company money. It functions through hype. There's another way to give musicians publicity, through internet music sharing. If someone says, here's a nice song, let me mail you a copy. Well, someone says this to his friend. Well, then another person hears that song. This is a way of giving musicians publicity that's healthy for music. one that helps replace the music factories with musical artisanship. I don't think it's good for music to have music factories. After all, they call themselves the music industry. That means that they're making the music in a factory. They bring in trainloads of money and they squeeze it into something that pretends to be music. Well, that's junk. No wonder it's so bad. So let's get rid of these music factories. These are arrogant companies that go around threatening the public, being nasty to the public, trying to take away our freedom. They deserve to be eliminated. There's nothing wrong with making records and selling them. And as I've described this compromised copyright system, I think it would be fine if for 10 years those record companies were forced to pay money to the musicians. Not like today's record companies that usually don't pay any money to the musicians. I think it would be good if they did have to. But the major record companies of today have been so arrogant and nasty to the public that they have no right to exist. If we abolish them, that's a benefit. Now, there are some exceptions to what I've been telling you. There are a few musicians, a small fraction, the ones who are superstars and have been and they've been superstars for a long time, and they finish their first record contract. Well, then they can negotiate another contract which is not unfair to them. Those are the musicians who really do get some money if you buy their records. But those musicians have plenty of money. If they got somewhat less, it would be no disaster. So, if we legalize internet music sharing, there will be no problem. And in general, musicians will be supported as well as they are now. But we might want to support musicians better than they are now. The current system works so badly. We might want a better one. Well, I have two suggestions for how to make a better one. Of course, it's crucial not to go through the record companies, because the record if we try to support musicians more through the record companies will keep it. They won't let the musicians get anything. That's the whole point. The reason the system is so unfair is because the record companies have all the power, and an unknown musician has no power. So the record companies treat them like dirt. So I have two suggestions. One suggestion is through a kind of tax. Suppose we tax blank CDs or connection to the internet or whatever, and use that money to pay to musicians in order to support musicians. And we should give all of that money to musicians only, well, musicians and composers, but none to corporations, only to the actual people who participated creatively in making the music. And second, we should do it based on their popularity, but not in a linear proportion. Because a superstar might be 1,000 times as popular as most good musicians. But it makes no sense to give the superstar 1,000 times as much money. Maybe 10 times as much money, but not 1,000. So let's take a function that tapers off. It keeps on going up, but more and more slowly. And so this way, the superstar who's 1,000 times as popular will get more, but not 1,000 times more. And this way, the same quantity of money will effectively support more musicians. The crucial thing is to support them well enough that they don't have to have another job and they can be full-time practicing musicians so that they can be as good as possible. They can realize their full potential as musicians. So we can set up the system so that once a musician has a certain amount of popularity, she gets to be supported well enough to be a full-time musician. And if she gets really famous, she'll get more, but we won't waste the money making a few musicians rich so that they can buy 10 Rolls Royces and 5 mansions. There's no need for that. So this is one proposal, but I have another idea that doesn't involve taxes at all. Oh, before I move on, I should point out that this tax would not have to be a lot of money. A few years ago, I read that in the US, people paid an average of $20 a year for music, and that the major record companies pay 4% of their income to musicians. Well, this suggests that musicians are getting an average of $1 per person per year. I don't know any figures for South Korea, but I'm guessing it's approximately similar. $1 per person per year. That's not a lot of tax money. You don't have to worry that it will bother you. Maybe let's make it $2 per person per year, because then half of it could go to the composers, half to the musicians. Now, that 4% is how much they pay to all the musicians. But almost all of that is the superstars. So the superstars get more than 4% of their sales figures, and all the rest get zero, or pretty close to zero. So that's the tax method. The other method is through voluntary payments. Imagine that every music player has a button on it which says, send $1 to the band. And if you push that button, you pay a dollar to the musicians and composers who made the thing you're listening to, or that you just did listen to. And you can push it whenever you want, or not. But why wouldn't you? I expect that people would be happy to press this button once a month, unless they're poor. If they're poor and they need to save every little bit of money, then they won't push the button. But that's okay. We don't need the musicians to be getting their money from poor people. There are plenty of people in the world who are not poor who can support the musicians and who'll never notice paying $1 a month. Like, would anyone here be unhappy sending $1 a month to some musician whose music you like? Of course not. And if we wanted to encourage this, instead of a nasty, cruel public relations campaign telling you that if you share, you're a pirate, that's nonsense. Don't ever call sharing piracy. Sharing is friendship. But instead of that nasty PR campaign, we could have a nice, friendly one. Have you sent a dollar to your favorite band this month? Why not? Don't you like the music? Help support music. Push the button this month. Or even every week. I think this system would work a lot better than the present system. The crucial thing is just to make it easy enough. Right now, if you really want to go to the trouble, you can find an address, you can write a check and mail it, but that's a lot of work. That probably takes 15 minutes. So, of course, people don't do it very often. But if all you had to do was push the button, it would be so easy. And the money itself is nothing. So that's my suggestion. My two suggestions for a better system to support the arts. So I'd like to mention that we have a campaign of protests to fight digital restrictions management. You can find it on defectivebydesign.org, because products designed to restrict the user are defective. They're intentionally defective. They are defective by design. A month ago, we had 300 actions in parallel. There are now 15,000 people signed up in this campaign to participate in protests, and you can make it bigger. The bigger we make it, the more effective it is. Someone from Disney said in an interview, if the public knows about DRM, we've lost. So help us teach the public what DRM stands for. So I've got some things to give out. Where is the bag? So I've got some FSF stickers. And I've also got cards you can use to join the Free Software Foundation if you want to, but you can also do it online through fsf.org. And also as a fundraiser, I have some elegant pins and key rings to sell on behalf of the Free Software Foundation. So is there time for me to answer questions? Is there time for me to answer any questions? Too bad. Well, I'll go out. You have another thing about to start, right? So I'll go outside, and then I'll give out the stickers and sell the things to sell.